Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We want to welcome this morning students from Augusta High School. Would they please stand? Thank you for standing and thank you for coming. We're delighted to have you. The Augusta High School students are here with our Caught with Class program, which is sponsored by both the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. It's a national award-winning program. The students have received the briefs and other materials about this case and may have discussed this case with counsel or others. We're delighted you could make it, and part of this program is that you meet with a justice at noon. So let me start introducing the court to you. On my far right is Justice David Prosser. Seated next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Justice Bradley is the justice with whom you will meet at noon. You will be joined by other high school students. My immediate right is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. My immediate left is Justice John Wilcox, and to his left, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far left, Justice Diane Sykes. With the introductions made, I'll call the second case for today, 01-3100-CR, State versus Church. Representing Mr. Church is James Fullen, Assistant Public Defender. Mr. Fullen.
Thank you, Your Honor. I am Jim Fullen, Assistant State Public Defender, and I am representing William Church today. This is my second appearance before this court for Mr. Church. The other one was down in Kenosha when the state withdrew its from its position, and this court dismissed an earlier review as improvidently granted. So we won that case. High fives all around. Unfortunately, I'm here again because, as a result of winning his appeal, Mr. Church is doing four more years in prison.
Nothing to do with legal counsel.
Right? It's wins like that.
Congratulations.
Good news, bad news.
If Mr. Church hadn't brought that appeal or had lost, he'd be 4 years better off than he is today. You know, in a logical universe, when this went back for resentencing, as the Court of Appeals directed, and as was the law at the time, that's the remedy, you would think that Mr. Church would get less time. First time he was sentenced in 1997, he was sentenced on five counts. When he got back for resentencing, only four counts. When he was first sentenced in 1997, he was in complete denial about this offense. He did not cooperate in the pre-sentence investigation report, wouldn't discuss this with the probation agent assigned to his case, expressed no empathy or sympathy for his victim, and along the way, on several occasions, denied that he needed to be treated as a sexual offender. When the case comes back in 2001, Mr. Church gives an allocution in which he admits the offense, expresses empathy for his victim, and asks for sexual offender treatment. He didn't have any prison discipline problems in the meantime, in the 4 years between the two sentencing. And I would just like to quote one of the many letters that were sent to the parole board by the people in Titus, Texas. The graveyard shift wrote, "Church is a very polite and respectful person and worker. He has always been willing to help where needed without complaint or argument. We have enjoyed and appreciated his company and hard work." Now, there's a collection of these kinds of letters that's in the appendix to our Court of Appeals brief. I didn't put them in the brief here. But that's an example. Not only did he have no misconduct in prison, but he was viewed by the deputies that were guarding him as one of their most polite, respectful, and hardest working prisoners that they knew. Now, the state has attempted to argue that Mr. Church dropped out of counseling, refused counseling, or didn't participate in sexual offender treatment. But that's not true. They've cited Larry Stubendick. Larry Stubendick was resentenced, and he got a longer sentence because he had dropped out of a counseling program. After 1 month, he said he didn't like the philosophy of that program. Church didn't drop out of any treatment program. He didn't discontinue participating in any treatment program. He didn't refuse any treatment program. And the record in this case demonstrates that even if he demanded every day to be put in the SOTP program, the Sexual Offender Treatment Program at Oshkosh, he couldn't have got in. Because that program, the most intensive program that the state has for sexual offenders, takes 4 years to do. And typically, people that go through that program are not returned to the general population of prison. Therefore, they're not put in the program until 4 years before their mandatory release date. So whether he wanted treatment or didn't really had no effect on him and where he was placed by the Department of Corrections. Now, the right to appeal is a constitutional right in Wisconsin. I don't think it is federally, but Article 1, Section 21, Paragraph 1 of the Wisconsin Constitution gives people the right to appeal. And it's that right that was chilled by the additional time that Mr. Church was given. It was a vindictive sentence. Under federal case law, there's like a presumption that if the same judge gives you more time without a new trial, there's a presumption that this is a vindictive sentence, and the state has to rebut that presumption. And
also, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I just want to ask you, because when you start talking about the vindictive sentence and the new information or the information that the judge had, and as I recall, and you can correct me, this was basically the same judge here.
It was the same judge that sentenced him the first time.
The new information to the judge, and I know your comment in your brief, was that, yes, the elocution, what you're talking about, that he had denied that, you know, the participation in the crime, and now he was admitting or accepting what he felt was his responsibility in that. What, if any, effect do you think that had to do with the vindictiveness? In other words, you're talking about that was the one change that is in the record that was different. What is your thought on that?
I think that normally this court reviews a sentence, there's a presumption that the trial judge knows what he's doing and that the trial judge is reasonable, and the burden is on the defendant to show that it was not a reasonable sentence. But I think when a person gets a longer sentence and there's been no new facts brought out about the crime or the offender's character or the need to protect the public, those were all brought out the first time. In fact, the judge very neatly summarized that and said, we're in the same place we were 4 years ago. What's changed? 4 years have passed and you haven't admitted this offense until 10 minutes ago. That, in the mind of the trial judge, was what justified her giving him additional time.
Could he legally be compelled to admit the offense while his direct appeal was still pending?
No, he couldn't under Tate against Schwartz. He can't be compelled to admit the offense while his direct appeal is pending. But the direct appeal, I think, was over by this time. Yes, it was over. In fact, it was still a live case because it went back for resentencing. So it's still a live case. And they couldn't compel him.
Essentially, he's getting greater punishment for not admitting the offense
during the 4 years.
Does Tate have any application?
That he needs sexual offender treatment. If you don't want to go to him actually incriminating himself, you know, he could have admitted along the way, but didn't until resentencing, that he needed treatment for this. And he could have, along the way, expressed some empathy for his victim, and he didn't do that until the allocution at resentencing. But I think if any facts changed, they were more positive than before. The judge said it took you 4 years to hit this, to get to this point. And therefore, I'm taking away those 4 years. I think they've been wasted. You haven't admitted the offense till today. And I'm going to take those 4 years away from you. You know, but I think if you really honestly think about what Judge O'Brien said, this was the basis for the increased time, is that it took him 4 years to get there. And that can apply to anybody that's ever resentenced. It's always going to be later in life that he comes back for resentencing. And if a judge can just say, well, you haven't done enough in the meantime, you know, then I don't understand what the rule's about. It's always going to be later when you get resentenced. And since he had such a great record in prison, and since he did, finally, by allocation at the resentence, admit things and ask for treatment, I think the judge was very concerned about getting him into treatment.
Counsel, it's always accepted, I think, that your record in prison, you're saying you're expected to do well, and so you're saying I had good time and it was in prison. As I recall, having done some sentencing when I was on the trial bench, you really didn't take that into account.
It's not a ground for a time cut. Right. The fact that you're doing well in prison has been recognized as not a new factor that would allow the judge to cut your time. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Finish.
Well, since he's being sentenced on fewer counts, you know, I don't understand how he comes out higher. I mean, all we're asking from this court is that you vacate that sentence and put him back to where the judge had him in 1997. That's the relief that we're asking from this court.
Mr. Fullen, what I wanted to ask is that you've been critical in your brief of the fact that the sentencing that occurred here was on all counts.
Yes.
Apparently, the Court of Appeals felt that that was required by State versus Gordon. Why do you feel that the Court of Appeals was wrong in that regard, that if there was going to be resentencing, it should not have been on all counts?
Well, I think the court sent a strong hint to me. They said I litigated the wrong issue, and if I litigated the issue of how he got to be resentenced on his sexual assault count when the appeal was about the enticement counts, maybe they could have granted me some relief. But they said, no, we can't, because Gordon says. So I'm asking this court to reconsider Gordon. And I think if you do remand for a resentencing, you could decide which counts are implicated in the appeal.
Do you think Gordon really clearly requires resentencing in all counts in situations like this one?
That was the mandate of the court. My colleague in my office, Donna Hintz, litigated that case, asked this court to reconsider that mandate, and this court turned her down. And she made many of the same arguments I make in my brief, that the cases cited by the court for that remedy in Gordon don't really support it. They're different. They're distinguishable. They involve interconnected counts and so on and so forth.
What do you think Gordon should stand for?
Well, it's tricky because I do think there are cases where, you know, the sentence that's the longest is the one that gets reversed. And we don't want to make this into a game. You know, we're not asking that it be a game. We're asking that this court, or if it can't decide, that when this court remands for resentencing, it asks the trial court.
Well, did you go back to Gordon and determine what the various sentences were, and were the sentences in Gordon such that you couldn't upset one without upsetting all of them?
No, they were not. Two of them were, but two others were not. They were independent counts. And it just, I don't think, was carefully considered by this court why Ms. Gordon should be resentenced on the other two counts that were not related. The appeal involved a felony murder and an underlying felony, and those were determined to be multiplicitous. But there were two other counts that were not involved in the appeal, kind of like this case, and that was resentenced for those two.
But counsel, in Gordon, it wouldn't have made sense to have just gone back for resentencing. In Gordon, the kidnapping was 15 years, right? There was then 8 years to run concurrently with kidnapping. Robbery, 8 years to run concurrently with kidnapping. And then a second-degree murder, 15 years to run consecutively to the other three sentences. Which one was knocked out in Gordon?
Well, probably the kidnapping. I'm not sure.
Kidnapping, the first one. So what you knocked out in Gordon was the offense upon which the others either ran concurrently or consecutively. Sentence wouldn't have made much sense unless you did something with it. And when you look at the other cases on which Gordon relied, in all of those, as I go back and reread them, the sentence may not have made much sense to the trial court, when the trial judge was sentencing for a group of, in those cases they were repeater and enhancer predominantly, because the judge might have a very well sentenced differently without the repeater. So they were sent back in order for the trial judge to determine what the trial court's goal was in the sentencing and put it all together, rather than, as you say, make it a game of which one you're going to knock out. So in all of them, they were done that. And Gordon relied on a whole set of cases that overruled Olson, which had held otherwise, again, under a particular statute that dealt with the enhancer. So how do you deal with the issue, which I think is really tough, of where you knock out a particular conviction for which the trial court has set a sentence, and how do you deal with that when another conviction is knocked out, and so the sentencing scheme of the trial court appears to have been changed? Now, in your particular case, these were all concurrent sentences, weren't they?
In my case, it was concurrent probations. He only got a sentence on the one count
right.
that got
The others were concurrent and they were probation.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
So apparently the trial court judge did not increase sentences because, or change a pattern because of a particular offense. Is that your position?
I think that the second issue in our case, the Gordon issue, would drop away if Judge O'Brien, instead of enhancing the sexual assault, had resentenced on the non-multiplicitous count and say, well, instead of probation, I'm not going to give you 4 years consecutive. If that had happened, then the whole second part of our brief would drop away. She chose to enhance the sentence that had been imposed. She left the same penalty on the one surviving enticement count that she had imposed the first time. But, you know, if she'd done it differently, then the Gordon issue would have fallen away. But it didn't. And I do think it's a tricky thing. I think this court could decide, here's the counts that are entailed in this appeal. When you said this was wrong, it involved another count, too, because it was an enhancer rather than a separate crime. And those two are going to be remanded, or something like that. You could decide that. Or you could remand and say, first we want the trial court to decide whether our decision totally upsets the sentencing scheme. And if the trial court says, yes, it did, then I think it can resentence. You know, and we have other arguments about whether it was vindictive or not, but I do think you could allow the trial court to decide what upset its sentencing scheme. In this case, the two multiplicitous counts that were appealed both resulted in 24 years probation. And obviously all probations are concurrent. So it wasn't, as the Court of Appeals said in its first decision, you know, we can't really say that this upset the court's sentencing scheme. We can't say it because he gave him concurrent probation for the two counts, and if only one is good, you know, it's very likely that the other one is going to stay the same.
What you want is this court to look at more carefully when it remands whether or not it's going to do that.
Or tell the trial court.
Or set as a standard that the trial court in resentencing consider its original sentencing scheme or concept.
Right.
Okay.
That's the relief I think would make the most sense. And that's what we're asking you to do with Gordon. You can't overrule the whole case. It's a good case, and there's a lot of good stuff in it. But I don't think this court was as careful as it might have been about ordering resentencing on the counts that weren't connected to the felony murder.
Let me just ask you this. Do you agree that we'll start at the beginning. The trial court on resentencing can consider events after the original sentencing. We agree.
Of course, we all agree.
Okay.
Right.
The event here considered was failure to seek treatment and failure to take responsibility. Is that right? What
yes,
else?
Yes. Well, I think that's the fair reading of that one paragraph where O'Brien says it's the same case as before. The only difference is it's 4 years later and until 10 minutes ago. So taking that as a good summary, you know, she said all the other factors are the same. The crime hasn't changed. Your character hasn't changed. The need for protecting the public hasn't changed. So the only thing that changed is 4 years passed without your taking responsibility.
And the evidence for failure to seek treatment was what?
Mr. Church had on occasion or two asked to remain in Titus, Texas.
I think that asking to stay in Texas rather
than come back to Oshkosh where the treatment program that the department wanted to put him through was. And I think he told somebody at some point along the line that he didn't think he needed treatment. He did say that at some point, not to the court, but those two things, I think, are the basis of the state's claim that this is a case like Stubendick, which I don't think it is.
And what was the evidence that he didn't take responsibility?
Well, he never...
Is this a trial or a plea?
Oh, it was a trial, and he fought it, and he wouldn't cooperate in the first PSI. You know, he wouldn't talk to the agent that wanted to interview him for it. You know, and I don't think anybody's saying that he did take responsibility, although he must have at some point before allocution on resentencing. You know, and I made a big argument in the Court of Appeals, left it out of the case now, that this was because of his church activities. It's because he was in a faith community that he was able to come. I mean, a lot of sexual offenders are in denial, a lot, when it starts. And there's been some studies done that say that being in denial does not affect recidivism. If you're familiar with the works of Carl Hansen, he did a meta-analysis of sexual offender recidivism in the Journal of Consulting and Clinical Psychology, 1998, that studies for like 29,000 offenders and looking for factors to predict recidivism. And denial is not a significant predictor of sexual recidivism. It's a pretty small statistical correlation. So, you know, I just want to make sure the court is aware of that fact, that being in denial does not have a statistically significant effect on recidivism as a sexual offender.
I'd like to go back to something, that you said early on in your argument. As I understand the facts here, your client has been a model prisoner in all respects, and that the only new factor that the trial judge based the increased sentence on here was his lack of rehabilitative progress in terms of sex offender treatment and acceptance of responsibility, et cetera, correct?
Correct.
And if the law is that lack of rehabilitative progress is not a new factor sufficient to justify a sentence modification downward on the defendant's motion, why shouldn't, you know, what's good for the goose be good for the gander, so to speak, and lack of rehabilitative progress without more, without, you know, violent episodes in prison, et cetera, be sufficient to justify an increase in the sentence?
I don't understand how logically it can justify an increase because the record in this case demonstrates that he couldn't have got in the program until 4 years before MR, and he wasn't to that point yet. So it didn't really matter as far as his progress in rehabilitating himself that he asked for or didn't ask for. If he had beat the doors of the prison every day and said, please send me to Oshkosh, I want to have treatment, it wouldn't have made any difference, as Dr. Alexander testified in this case. Wouldn't have made any difference.
The law is the same, basically. That's not a sufficient new factor to justify a reduction, and there has to be a sufficient new factor.
There does have to be one for
to go upward.
To go upward, right. Well, I suppose, you know, if it is sauce for the goose, you know, you could look at it that way. It certainly seems to me that, you know, that might have...
Who's the gander here?
Well, the goose is trying to get a time cut. The goose is trying to get a time cut, and you can't get it because you're making progress in prison, and the gander is trying to not get a time increase. And we say you can't block that because you weren't aggressive enough about seeking treatment?
Okay, I have a question. We agree that the events come to the court's attention subsequent to the first sentencing that warrant an increase, and we agree that the court must specify its grounds, right?
Yes.
And it seems to me you're arguing here that the sentence increase has to be reasonably related to these grounds.
Correct.
Because increasing the sentence here, is your argument, is not reasonably related to rehabilitative treatment, because he still had 9 years to go on his sentence. He had an inchoate right to get out. When was his mandatory release date?
Oh, I don't know. It was an old law sentence. It was imposed in 97. It was 13 years, so two-thirds of 13. You know, a little more than 8 years from 97, about 95 would be his
MRB. So he had at least 8 years that he had to face it. He had 4 years at least remaining. And so his rehabilitation would take about 4 years. So she did not, the judge here did not have to increase the sentence to relate it to the grounds, which he said, which is rehabilitative treatment in prison.
Yes, Mr. Becker has cited a 2002 case in which a court was allowed to consider pre-sentence jail credit in order to structure a sentence that would allow the treatment to take place. And, you know, that I think is acceptable. This court is so held, or the Court of Appeals at least. And so you're allowed to look at the amount of time it would take to complete the program. It's allowed to be considered in that way.
And indeed, the Fens case said that the sentence had to be appropriate given the factors considered. So that's your argument simply stated.
Probably our third part of our brief, right. It's not appropriate to consider that it took him 4 years to get this far. It's not an appropriate factor. I think how long it would take him to get through his treatment program is appropriate under Fens. But the fact that it took him 4 years to reach the point of allocution at the resentence is not an appropriate factor.
Well, we can change the facts a bit. And suppose he only had a year and a half left until mandatory release, and the rehabilitative program was 4 years, and the judge says, look, you haven't done anything in prison to rehabilitate. You're in denial. You won't go to any of these programs. I'm increasing your sentence to get you to think about participating in these programs. And we need 4 years, so I'm increasing your sentence to 2.5 more years, or whatever it's needed to keep you in for the four-year program.
Fens says that's okay.
Pardon me?
Fens says that's okay.
And this case would not disturb that.
What no, he still had time for SOTP at the time he was resentenced. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Fullen. David Becker, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the Court. I am Assistant Attorney General David Becker, representing the plaintiff respondent in this case, the state of Wisconsin. There are two issues, basically, that I think have two distinct issues that I think have been addressed here in argument this morning. One is the due process issue of whether or not the trial court could properly increase the sentence based on the reasons it gave for increasing the sentence. The other is the what I'll just loosely call the Gordon issue that really came out of the court's questioning with respect to just exactly what sentences should be fair game for modification when there's a remand in a case like this, where one of the convictions has been set aside. Addressing the due process issue first, I think our brief, I don't think I have anything to add to our brief. I think our brief lays out, primarily by relying on the Court of Appeals decision, which I think did a marvelous job of responding to the very kinds of arguments that were raised in the brief, in the defendant's brief, and now are raised here again this morning, with regard to whether or not the reason that the trial court gave for increasing the sentence was a valid one, and in particular responding to the defendant's contention that, look, even if I had requested the sex offender treatment program, I would not have gotten it because they would not have started it until about the time that the trial court was resentencing, in other words, about 4 years or so before the end of my sentence. The Court of Appeals laid out very nicely, I thought, the response to that, and that is that they did not read the court of the trial court's decision as just relying on the fact that he hadn't gotten sexual offender treatment. They said that it was the fact that he hadn't done anything. And I think that one thing that comes through clear from the testimony of Dr. Alexander is that before you get the sexual offender treatment program, if you're a denier, you have to go through the deniers program. And he hadn't made any attempt to do that.
Do they have a deniers program in Texas?
Absolutely not. I think that the record is absolutely clear on that.
So what did he have to do, demand to come back to Wisconsin?
Well, he certainly should have requested to come back to Wisconsin rather than affirmatively requesting to stay down in Texas, which is what the record clearly shows he did.
Don't we have some case law that says prisoner doesn't have a right to be in the state or out of the state?
Right. I'm not suggesting that his demands would have necessarily been met.
Okay. But he had to make this kind of show.
But I think the trial court was concerned that the system didn't provide him, didn't meet his needs. I think the trial court would clearly have admitted that if he had tried to get into these programs and they were full or the state didn't want to bring him back from Texas and what have you, I think it goes without saying almost that the trial court would not have found that to be a new factor that justified any increase in sentence. It was the fact that he had affirmatively denied the crime. He affirmatively denied his need for treatment. Opposing counsel admits that this morning. He had affirmatively requested to stay down in Texas at points where, at least I assume that that request would have been given some, a request to come back to Wisconsin would have been given some weight. And so it's on that basis that the trial court found that, and as she put it, quoted in the Court of Appeals decision, and I neglected to quote it in at the end of a quote that I had in my brief from the Court of Appeal, from the trial court. She said that 4 years have passed. We need to start at square one again, and hopefully within the time that he is incarcerated under the new sentence, Mr. Church can make the progress I had hoped he would make 4 years ago and has not. And there's the key. When she sentenced him 4 years earlier, she assumed that those first four years of his sentence, there would be some progress toward rehabilitation.
Did she say that at the sentencing?
Pardon me?
Did she say that at the first sentencing?
No, but I think that she certainly said that one of her primary, if not her primary concern, was the need for rehabilitation, that this was at
the first sentence.
At the first sentencing, that this was clearly a man who needs rehabilitation by virtue of the nature of the crime.
So she clearly premised her decision on his lack of rehabilitative progress.
I don't think there's any question about that.
And I agree with you on that.
I want to do it so he can make the progress I had hoped he would have made 4 years ago and has not. That's, I think, the key.
And I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Fullen, although I'll try to do a better job of it because I didn't ask it very well or correctly the first time. So if in the law of sentence modification, rehabilitative progress is not a new factor to justify a downward sentence modification, why should the other side of the coin be legally permissible, that lack of rehabilitative progress is sufficient to justify an increase in the sentence on resentencing under these circumstances?
I guess that's because that's the way it is. That's the way Wisconsin case law has shaken out. The Carter case, I think, actually addresses this, where Carter is the case where you said that any time there's a resentencing, and we don't care the reason why, the state had tried to make a distinction in Carter and said if it's one scenario, then there ought to be a limitation the court should limit its consideration to what was confronting it at the time of the original sentencing, and then should try and modify the sentence to effect that original sentencing intent. And in the other scenario, it would be fair game to consider all factors, including those that arose after the original sentencing. This Court expressly said we don't agree with the State, and there should be – the rule should be at a resentencing for whatever reason under whatever scenario, the Court – it should be the whole – all of the post-original sentencing factors should be fair game for the Court to consider. It specifically said we're not dealing with the situation. I think it did. I reread Carter in the last couple of days in preparation for this argument, but I have this recollection that specifically said we're not dealing with the situation of attempts of sentence modification based on new factors. Does that on its face appear to be maybe not good for the goose is good for the gander? Maybe, but I guess maybe that's where Wisconsin law presently stands. Now, I think this is one of the situations where if you're going to start pulling on a thread here in terms of reworking Wisconsin law, I'm not sure where you're going to end up. I'm not so sure if Carter is going to continue to be good law. I'm jumping ahead now to the request to modify Gordon or overrule Gordon, but I would have a difficult – I have an impossible time here in front of you to try and suggest some other alternative that may or may not seem fairer to maybe effect a good-for-the-goose, good-for-the-gander approach. I can't do it. It seems to me based on present Wisconsin law, what happened here was absolutely, unquestionably, perfectly appropriate because under Leonard, if in the resentencing, under Leonard and Carter requiring you to consider all the factors, Leonard saying if you find new factors that arose since the original sentencing that justify an increased sentence, you can impose an increased sentence. Under those cases, there is no question that the trial court was perfectly right in doing or had the authority to do what it did. I mean, this was a case of really an exercise of sentencing discretion. It was very concerned, obviously, that what it had thought was going to happen 4 years earlier had not happened. And to remedy that, it decided to increase the sentence by 4 years. And I don't see how that is at all questionable or challengeable under existing law.
Doesn't that really constitute a four-year encumbrance on the right to an appeal? I mean, you win, here's four more years.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. If she had imposed it for that reason, or if there had been no new factors, and it was purely because she wanted to punish him for having exercised his right to appeal, then we would have a real problem here. But Leonard and Pierce say that that there is no improper encumbering of the right to appeal so long as you justify the increase in the sentence based on new objective factors that you weren't aware of or that occurred since the first sentencing.
All right. And what were those, I asked opposing counsel, as far as the four additional years in her statement, there was the elocution, okay, I'm now responsible for what I did. And then her response was, well, you didn't do anything, but the point is that, opposing counsel indicates, that there was nothing he could do as far as the sex offender treatment program at that time. Nothing, as he said, he could have written letters, volunteered, etc. So that in itself was something that he could not have done anything with.
And I return to what the Court of Appeals said in what I think is an absolutely sound answer to that argument, and that is that she wasn't simply concerned about the sexual offender treatment program and his getting into that. She was concerned about taking affirmative steps toward rehabilitation. And the sexual offender treatment program would not have even been available to him because he had to get into the deniers program.
Was the affirmative steps that he was to take?
He should have requested that he be put in the deniers program. He should have requested that he be returned to Wisconsin so that he could get treatment.
But as, okay. He would not have, Are you saying that that was a legitimate option, that he would have been returned to Wisconsin for that program at that time?
We will never know, but we do know that he affirmatively put himself in a position where he couldn't get the treatment, and that's what concerned the judge. He also and he made his views on that clear before he went to Texas at the initial program classification interviews that are referred to in the updated pre-sentence report. He affirmatively said, "I don't need treatment." And the pre-sentence investigator said all treatment is voluntary, and the judge put those two things together and said, well, as long as he's saying he's in no need of treatment, they weren't going to give him treatment. Now, would they have given him treatment had he? I'd like to believe that he would have gotten into the deniers program somewhere along the way. Another way of looking at this is that he certainly made it clear that he was a much tougher nut to crack than the judge probably thought originally with regard to rehabilitating him. She had thought that there were going to be some steps that were going to be taken, or at least that he was not going to set up affirmative roadblocks to his rehabilitation, as he did by denying the need for any, not requesting it, asking to stay where it wasn't available. And that she had misgauged what she thought would the progress he would make toward rehabilitation during those first 4 years. I think that's the thrust of her remarks.
The opportunity to reevaluate all of that would never have arisen had he not won his appeal.
Pardon me?
The opportunity to reevaluate all of that would never have arisen if he had not won his appeal.
Well, that's true. That's true, but that's the risk that one runs when one appeals a case. You do not run the risk that you are going to be punished for appealing. Pierce, Leonard, all of the Pierce Leonard all the cases in the Pierce Leonard line of cases make it clear that you cannot be punished. And to protect that, have set up a prophylactic rule that does, as opposing counsel says, thrust the burden on the sentencing judge, and then ultimately on the state as we try to sustain the sentencing judge, to affirmatively, not just simply declare, I'm not punishing you. So don't take this as punishment. I'm throwing four more years on after you won your appeal. The judge has to affirmatively point to new objective factors, either not known at the time of the original sentencing or occurring since the time of the original sentencing, that justify the increase in the sentence. And that's precisely what the judge did in this case. And having done that, under Pierce, under Leonard, under that line of cases, this then is not punishing a guy for taking an appeal.
Mr. Becker?
Are you finished?
I am. Well, here she added, the trial judge added 4 years to the sexual assault offense.
Right.
What if she had left that alone and taken the remaining count of enticement and said new factors, citing the very same things that she had, and I'm going to give you an additional 4 years to run consecutive to the sexual assault. I'm obviously back to the Gordon issue.
Yeah.
To some extent. Do we have a problem then?
I think I heard my opponent correctly this morning, and he can correct me if I'm wrong now in what I understood him to be saying when he gets up on rebuttal. I understood him to be saying that we would have no Gordon problem. Right. He would still argue that
right.
What the judge invoked was not sufficient to justify an increase in sentence, but he would have no Gordon problem.
That's the point that I'm getting at. Because it strikes me that the problem here, at least with respect to the Gordon thing, is that she took a count that was not a part of the appeal and affected the sentencing on that count. Whereas, really, wouldn't at least fairness, if not the law or due process, dictate that she take only the count that was the subject of appeal?
I'm not sure, at least in the abstract, that that's the case. Now, let's just remove ourselves from the facts of this case, and without necessarily even constructing a hypothetical, just let me state the position that I would have. Maybe you have to state a hypothetical to make the position clear, but there certainly could be a way in which the sentence structure has been originally crafted that the only way in which you can really attempt to put the case, just focusing on trying to get your sentence back in line with your original intent, which was talked about in the context of the discussion with Gordon earlier, there may well be cases where you could, where you really needed to reach out to those other counts because of the way the sentence was structured. And I should also point out this, I think. This cuts both ways. This is a two-way street. And let's talk about this. Let me not talk about this case, but let's talk about a case where there's, five counts, and on the first count, and let's say they're all basically the same crime, and on the first count, somewhat similar to what the judge did in here, he puts all the prison time on the first count, and then he puts a bunch of concurrent probations, but I need five fingers. First count is up here. He puts all the prison time on the first count.
You may need a diagram on this one.
Well, that's why my hand is substituting for the diagram. And he puts the consecutive but concurrent probations on the other four counts. And now he comes up on appeal, and the defendant wins because the appellate court concludes he was never guilty. The evidence was insufficient on all four of those counts. Now, the argument, your position, but I think where you were heading was to say, well, okay, that takes care of that, and this count kind of stands out by itself, and there shouldn't be resentencing on this count. But I think in that situation, the defendant would want resentencing on this account, because I assume that the judge, in imposing the sentence on this count, let's say he imposed the maximum, and maybe in the sentence remarks saying, I'm imposing the maximum because you didn't commit this crime just once, you committed it five times. A defendant would want to come back and reopen the sentence on that count, and let's say the defendant had never attacked that count on the appeal. He'd only attacked those four. He'd been successful, got him set aside on insufficiency of his grounds. He would want to come back, I think, and say, okay, that wasn't the subject of the appeal, but I want resentencing because I think when the judge imposed the maximum sentence, I've got nothing to lose. He imposed the maximum sentence. He can't impose anything more on me. And I think he was influenced by the fact that I committed this crime five times. We now know that I only committed it once.
Well,
and I'd like to go back. So I
think the defendant can, if he says that's a new factor and the court accepts that as a new factor.
Well, I suppose that might be an answer, but I think it's kind of a very circuitous route to get there. I mean, why not on the initial appeal simply do what I think Gordon says you do, is that when you set aside a conviction and or a sentence on a particular count, you send the whole ball of wax back to the trial court for resentencing because you don't know how that setting aside may have played into the other, or that, the one you set aside may have played into the sentence that was imposed.
Base sentence in Gordon, which was 15 years for kidnapping, disappeared as the result of the appeal. That was the count that was wiped out by the appeal. So all these other sentences that were supposed to follow the kidnapping charge had no base anymore. Whereas here, the base sentence, which was the sexual assault, wasn't affected at all. So there was no interdependency here there was in Gordon.
But I don't think
it was interdependency.
Yeah, but I don't think it was I don't necessarily believe that it was the interdependency necessarily, because I assume that what you had in mind, if nothing else, in Gordon, was the fact that we now know that the kidnapping and the felony murder were not two separate offenses on which you could impose 15 years and impose whatever consecutive it was. Justice Abramson had it all down before. I assume you, at the very least, were concerned about the fact that maybe this felony murder sentence needed to be increased to reflect the fact that originally the total ball of wax that the felony murder encompassed, which was both the felony murder and the kidnapping, had resulted in a total sentence of, was it 15 and 8 or, 23, and that maybe that sentence needed to be increased to 23 to now reflect that. So I don't think it was just the fact that there was that it was the way that sentence structure was, whether it had been that way or otherwise, I think that would have come into play.
But Mr. Becker, that's not the case here.
No.
Even accepting Gordon, and I think it turns on, at least the Gordon issue, turns on, I'm looking at Appendix 103, which is page 3 of the Court of Appeals decision. And there they repeat the language from Church 1. That's the high-five winning
right.
case, right?
Yep.
We know that the sentence for both counts of child enticement were withheld and that concurrent 24 years of probation consecutive to the prison term for sexual assault were ordered. Thus, our disposition would not in itself affect the duration of Church's prison sentence or his subsequent term of supervision. So the fact that you strike out one of the offenses doesn't change the sentence at all in this case, according to what it says. Nevertheless, and then this is the kicker sentence, we conclude we must vacate all sentences imposed for each of Church's four remaining convictions and remand for resentencing on one count of each second-degree child enticement. All the rest, C. Gordon. It's a very different sentencing structure here, and a very different sentencing structure that Gordon relied on in Ronzani and the other cases that were cited, which were penalty enhancement predominantly.
There's no question.
You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, but but that brings us back to the problem that I said earlier, and that is, I don't know how you're going to craft your decision in this case to describe the. There's so many possible permutations in this situation that I don't know how you're going to. It seems to me Gordon, if nothing else, has simplicity to commend it. Send the whole ball of wax back to the trial judge and let her sort this. Let her sort this out.
What's the standard that the trial judge should use for sorting it out? I mean, it's either we sort it out, which is always troublesome, especially when we're sorting what somebody else did and had in mind. So, what is the standard for sorting it out? Is it to implement the original sentencing design?
Well, that's what you rejected, I think, in Carter.
Well, okay.
You know,
what
so,
is the standard?
So now you. I think the standard is the combination of. I think the standard is the combination of Carter, Leonard, and Grabarczyk. And that is, Carter says you consider everything. That's the kind of the backdrop of the case. And Leonard says, Leonard says that you that having considered everything, you now can, if you want, increase the sentence if there is new information available to you. And Grabarczyk says in the alternative, you can take the approach that you just indicated, and that is that you can attempt to, without necessarily having new information, you can at least attempt to rearrange put the sentences back together on the remaining counts in such a way as to effectuate your original sentencing intent. I think that's the present state of the law, and I think it's not a bad state because I have this feeling, like I said, that you start tugging at any one of those threads, a lot of stuff is going to start unraveling, and maybe that's the nature of the law, and 2 years from now we can be trying to refine what you do in this case and correct mistakes if they were made and that kind of thing. Because the potential permutations are so infinite, I just have a hard time figuring out how you're going to provide that guidance that is going to necessarily cover all the cases.
Why can't in this particular case, just let's take this one, where removing a count, right, removing a conviction and removing that sentence leaves the defendant exactly where he was with the count. And you say where you've pulled this and he's left in exactly the same position, no resentencing.
And very limited decision to that effect?
Pardon me?
And a very limited decision, just limited to those kind of cases?
Sure. In the Gordon case, sentencing couldn't really, as I understand it, couldn't really be effectuated when you pulled the first plug on that. Do you disagree with that?
No, I agree with that.
And in the other cases, you had this sentence enhancement, essentially, and so that affected that and the initial crime that was there. So you'd send that back. But here, did it just, if this is right, now, if you think that the Court of Appeals was wrong in what I read to you, then that's another issue. But here, you pull that, he's left with one less conviction, but exactly the same sentence. You know, you're right. He should be complaining. He should get a shorter sentence because he has less.
You know what? And that's right. There is my answer.
That's right.
It's got to go back because the defendant has the potential argument of saying that 13 years you originally imposed was based on the fact that I had enticed this child twice, and now we know I enticed him once, that 13 should be 12 or 11 or 10.
Did he ask for that here?
Yes. Yes, that's... That was one of my main arguments as we lead into double jeopardy, which then led into Gordon, and that is that there's been a waiver in this case, and part of the waiver was in the first appeal in Church, in the conclusion of the brief, he said he wanted resentencing on the remaining counts, plural, not the remaining count of child enticement. So, and then when he went back, he originally said, we want resentencing. That's what he told the court according to the court minutes of the first hearing back in the trial court. And that's, I guess, that's what I'm talking about with this, you know, this thread pulling. I mean, there's so many permutations, plus there's two different interests to consider here. And so it seems to me that Gordon makes sense in the sense that it allows it to go back, and then all of these various interests can be sorted out, can be heard, the defendant can make his pitch for a lesser sentence. If there's been new factors, the judge can exercise the power that they have under Leonard to increase the sentence if those are present. So it seems to me it makes sense in all cases to do that.
Does it make any difference here that the state confessed error?
In the first appeal?
Does it make any difference in the legal analysis here? The state confessed error here, charged a multiplicitous count. Right.
Yeah, but we confessed error after we had lost. I mean, the control. We didn't confess error, so that the court, which led to the Court of Appeals decision. We fought that.
Changed position
in the Supreme Court, which resulted in your not doing anything with the case other than saying dismissal because it was improvidently granted.
As I understand the record, the state confessed error, said that the child enticement statute
were multiplicitous. Yeah,
multiple modes of commission rather than two offenses. And so it was essentially a state confession of error.
Yes. And I don't see how that has any impact because we're talking about what the Court of Appeals did long before that confession of error ever occurred. The Court of Appeals decision became the decision in this case. It was as if nothing had ever happened in this court, really. I mean, whatever, I don't know how it affects this, would affect this issue. But like as I say, that was part of the request for relief in the Court of Appeals, which the Court of Appeals granted the defendant. When he said, I want resentencing on the remaining counts. And I assume, I don't know, I mean, maybe it was a slip of the tongue, but I assume it could just as well have been, if I get rid of this one multiplicitous count, I have grounds for going back and telling the judge, you put all the imprisonment in this case on the one count, you thought you were sentencing on a ball of wax that included five counts, now there are only four. Reconsider whether or not your 13-year sentence wasn't influenced by the fact that you thought I had committed the crime of enticement twice. That could very well have been his thinking. And like I say, in my diagram case earlier with my five fingers, there are clearly cases where the defendant is going to want to even though, my five-finger case would fall within Justice Abramson's situation.
Within this case.
It would fall within the situation you posed, which is, the judge's sentence is left standing on the one count, the only one that really made any difference. The others have disappeared. There's no way the judge can do anything to increase them. But you'd still want to send it back, not for the state's benefit in that situation, but for the defendant's benefit. So,
counsel, I'd like to touch upon the final issue, and that is whether or not the judge here effectively denied Mr. Church his constitutional right to have credit for time served. I assume the law to be that you can increase the sentence for the appropriate reasons, and conversely, but you cannot for unlawful reasons. And one unlawful reason is to deny credit for time served. As I read this transcript, and I'm looking at pages 63 and 64 of the transcript, it seems to me that
this is the transcript of the resentencing?
Yes.
Thank you.
It seems to me that's exactly what the judge did here. She said, and I'm reading from, and she says exactly what her intent is. If she hadn't, I would feel differently. She says, I feel that those 4 years have been wasted and that to impose the same sentence today would, in effect, give Mr. Church credit for spending the last 4 years without acknowledging his offense and without doing anything to obtain treatment, either for himself or the public. A couple sentences down from that, she says, my intent there is to say, as I indicated, we are here 4 years later, 4 years have passed, we need to start at square one again. And hopefully within that time, he'll make progress. I read, in reading the Fens case, that was specifically to get someone into a treatment program. And as a trial court judge, I remember those kinds of arguments and letters from the Department of Corrections Secretary saying how long it's going to take to get into a program. But that's not what she was talking about here. I mean, her intent, because he didn't make any progress, was to start as though those years didn't exist. That's the way I read her transcript, which to me seems that she effectively denied him the 4 years. She added those 4 years back on and made a 17 years. Could you respond to that, please?
Yeah, I respond. I've got a red light on. I don't know how long the Court's going to let me want to go on this, because I think it's more complicated than just a simple sentence or two. I think this that what you have to do is you have to start from the Pierce case, which says that you have that right to that credit, but then says if there are new factors that justify an increase in the sentence, you can increase the sentence. And that, and in that situation where you found those new factors and you increase the sentence based on the new factors, you have, in effect, then, deprived the person of credit that was previously served to the extent that you increase the sentence. And so I think that your concern ultimately goes right back to whether or not Leonard Pierce was met, because if Leonard Pierce was met, then she validly increased the sentence, and I don't see how you can. You may be suggesting that this was not legitimate under Leonard Pierce.
I'm suggesting that you can increase the sentence and in essence wipe out time served, because there are reasons for you to increase the sentence, but the reason cannot be, my intent cannot be, to wipe out time served.
Well,
if de facto it happens for legitimate reasons, but here she articulated a reason, my intent is to wipe out the time served.
No, well, see, but that's not the way I characterize it. I characterize it, my intent is to, in the future, give us a long enough sentence so that what I thought was going to be happening in the original 13-year sentence now has time to happen. That's my answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Becker. Mr. Fullen.
Well, I think Justice Sykes has put her finger on the problem, which is, if he hadn't appealed, none of this could have happened to him. And therefore, whatever happened to him here is going to chill appeals. This is going to be a published decision, and it's going to chill appeals, because anybody that's worried about more time on some count that he has no problem with, that he has a reasonable explanation of finality in that sentence, that guy isn't going to appeal. And that's a problem. Now, we've, in our brief, offered three reasons why it's unconstitutional to do it this way. One, the sexual assault count wasn't before the Court of Appeals, and really, it was quite independent. It was tried separately. It wasn't part of a plea bargain. It wasn't part of a package sentence. I mean, there's just, like, no connection. So that's one. Second, the reasons given by the Court, you know, were not sufficient in this case. Now, this makes it a very fact-specific case, but if that's what it takes for Mr. Church to get relief, we'll take it on its facts. There just wasn't anything in the record that showed that he was resisting treatment, had refused treatment, had, you know, and he had acknowledged the offense, so it should have made his character look a little better the second time around. And the third one is
I'm surprised, Mr. Fullen, that you're so quick to say that you'll take a win.
That's right.
I think that's my obligation as counsel. Take a win and offer the court three ways to get there. You know, but the real problem is what Justice Sykes said. If he hadn't appealed, this couldn't have happened. You know, and this will chill appeals. It'll affect the way we advise clients that have an error in their case that does call for resentencing as the remedy. We always ask them, how are you doing in prison? Do you have major misconduct reports? No. Well, then maybe it's not such a risk. This man didn't. So it does affect the way we practice law and the way we advise clients about, well, I'm not sure you should take this point up. People want to withdraw their pleas all the time, and they got a good bargain, and we say, no, you got grounds to withdraw your plea, but you don't want to do that, do you? If they say yes, we do it, but we sometimes get a letter covering our rear end about it. So there are legal errors that never get brought to court because the defendant has a legitimate fear that he's going to get more time, and that didn't happen here.
Do you think it makes any difference that the state, to the due process analysis, that the state confessed error in this case, or is that just added insult to injury?
I don't think it makes much difference. The state didn't confess error at the Court of Appeals. They just changed their mind because they decided they'd rather get Gabriel Durango than William Church. That's all that happened, really. They had two cases. They had inconsistent positions. They had to withdraw for one. This court scheduled them back-to-back for argument. So that helped. But I don't think the fact that error was confessed here did anything other than take it out of this court. You know, the rest of the case turns on what the Court of Appeals said. And I would call your attention to the last paragraph of their decision. They go, well, this is a little different from cases where we remand for reimposition of sentence with a corrected understanding of the law. You know, if that could be a standard. You know, we've corrected your understanding of the law. This was only one count, not two. Now, resentence this. You know, but I don't think in this case it would have turned out the way it did. You know, now I think that can be a grounds. And that's why I think you can either decide yourself that you need to do that, or you can ask the trial court to make findings that it did upset the sentence structure improperly. Or, you can ask for that to be litigated below when you send it back for resentencing. Have the defendant, if he wants to be resentenced on everything, argue for it and say, I really deserve to be resentenced on everything. But I think that's a backdoor sentence mod. If you want a sentence mod, you should ask for a sentence mod and show a new factor. This is a backdoor way of getting it, and I don't think that's exactly proper either. So I would call to your attention the final paragraph of the Court of Appeals decision. I'm not challenging Carter. I think, and on resentencing, the court should be able to consider anything that happened before or since. And, you know, I think that's a good rule. It's a bright line rule. We ought to stick with it. But I am challenging Gordon because I just want this court to think about a little more carefully which counts are implicated and maybe ask for that in the briefs. Maybe the appellate court could say, which counts are you trying to get resentencing on? If the guy wants resentencing on everything, he can give reasons. So it gets litigated case by case. That's all I'm really asking this court to do. And finally, I agree with Justice Bradley. I think the words that the court used show that it was looking at the time served. It's quite clear from the words that the court used it was looking at the time served. Now, maybe it's permissible because it was time served without admitting the offense. But, you know, you want to be really careful, I think, about, you know, and I think if you want to give the trial court some deference here, and to the extent that you read what she said, what were her reasons for the additional time? And I think looking at that, it was time served.
Thank you, Mr. Fullen, and thank you, Mr. Becker, for your arguments in 01-31. 00-CR State Church. That concludes our hearing. We are in recess until 1:45. Mm-hmm.